Les conférences du Collège de France.
So thank you, Jean-François, for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for all for coming for my lecture. I am sorry if I disappoint you. So I will be speaking about polymer physics in the nucleus of a living cell. And since this is a series of four lectures, today it will be sort of an introduction. And I apologize to people who know everything that I will tell you. And please feel free to interrupt me at any point with either questions or statements that I misunderstand or misrepresent what I'm talking about. So feel free to interrupt me, that is fine. Okay, so the first thing that I wanted to tell you is that it's now almost exactly half a century since a revolution in polymer physics. And a big part of this revolution happened right here, in this very place, in the hands of Degenne, of course. And this is a paper. I remember reading this paper sitting in Moscow. I was a student at the time, doctoral student at the time. And we called this paper "All French Physicists Except the Clouseau." Jean-François, you were not known at the time. You existed, but you were not known. So it was a part of this revolution in polymer physics. And the interesting feature of this article is that it has two parts, essentially. It reports on two revolutions: a revolution in experimental ways of observation. It was first big paper on the use of neutron scattering to understand large-scale properties of polymers. And at the same time, it was the first practical, powerful use of scaling theory to understand polymers. And the combination created great impression. So I am used to think about this revolution in polymer physics as happening due to these three persons. And as we go through our four lectures about nuclear physics, we will encounter actually the ideas of all three of these people, one by one. But today, of course, is the person in the middle. So this is the paper, and this is a famous result, famous observation that osmotic pressure goes with concentration in this beautiful, very peculiar power, which is close to 9/4 instead of 2, and I will not go into the details of it, but this is experimental data from neutron scattering, and this is how this is for me the ideal how the science should work. There should be new advancement of experiment, new advancement in theory, and they should work hand in hand. So I will try to tell you that there is proportional, if not bigger, advancement in experimental aspects of nuclear physics, what I will call nuclear physics, but there is no proper proportional advancement in theory. And I will invite young people in the room to think of maybe they can really sort of play the role of Degenne in this case, if you are sufficiently ambitious. So here is cell nucleus. So cell nucleus is, of course, extremely complicated object, very small, about 10 micrometer in size for human cell, but extremely complex. Apart from DNA, which is almost all of the inheritance material in a human cell. There is also lots of other things, nucleoli, speckle, and many things are happening there all the time. So it's super complex. Just to give you a feeling about the numbers there, total length of DNA in every cell of your body is 2 meters, like this. Maybe it's a little more than the ends of my fingers. It's 2 meters. So if you think about volume, diameter of DNA, DNA itself is 2 nanometers. So in terms of volume, you can compute the volume, and it easily fits inside the nucleus of the diameter 10 micron. There is no problem in terms of volume. However, if you imagine increasing all the scales by 1 million, then you obtain the problem of packing 2,000 kilometers of some rope reasonably thin rope, but 2,000 kilometers. You have to put it inside the car. I always show this picture. I found it on the web. I have no clue who and for which purpose did this to the car. So this is what you should imagine doing. And this is super difficult, of course, because this DNA must be manageable. You have to read out certain genes, produce RNA, and so on. So very difficult. It's not unique to humans. You see that for different organisms, the length of the genome, if you read it from bottom to top, the more sophisticated is organism, the longer is the gene. It's not always, by the way, because of the number of genes, because yeast and we have practically the same number of genes. But it's all non-genomic, non-coding part of the DNA, whose purpose we don't, at least I don't quite understand. It's not genes, so we don't have more genes than yeast. Don't be too proud. But in any case, if you take the ratio of the length, genome length, to the place where the genome is stored, you see that the more sophisticated the organism, the bigger is this number. So to some extent, evolution is about how to pack more and more and more stuff into the place where this stuff is supposed to be. So let's go from the simplest, viruses. Viruses, so if you take a virus, this is virus, and if you take all the DNA out of the virus, it's quite impressive how much DNA was stored in this place. So the way they do it is quite elegant. You see, it's beautifully drawn here. And there are some details which I will not go into how this spool is organized. But in any case, it is just beautifully organized around like spool like this. It's organized in perpendicular direction and so on. So that's how it works for viruses, although you may already hear, you may ask, what about the charges of DNA? And this is an interesting question. So there is a big separate story about these charges. Now for bacteria, if you take E. coli bacteria and rupture it and allow DNA to spill out, you see that there are lots and lots of DNA. These pictures, the pictures like this, were actually taken by this lady, Ruth Kavenov, and There is, I found an interesting story. This is a copy of her obituary when she died. So the story goes that she was unable to receive support for her studies, doing electron microscopy of various molecular biological things. And therefore, what she did is she founded a company which produced T-shirts and aprons and other things like this, with pictures just like this. This is from T-shirt, okay? And with the profits from the sale of this T-shirt, she supported her studies. And somehow she was supported by famous Bruno Zim, but Bruno Zim was unable to finance this process. So these two, actually, Zim and Kavenov, these two people, they made fundamental discovery, which is the basis of everything that I will tell you afterward, which is that each chromosome in humans or mouse or Drosophila or anybody else, each chromosome is just one molecule of DNA. Not more and not less, it's just one. Of course, as always in biology, there are some exclusions and buts and so on, because, for instance, as cell functions, sometimes there is DNA damage in there. So if DNA breaks down, then there is, at this moment, technically speaking, there is more than one molecule of DNA. But then there are normally functional cells, there is repair and so on. So as a first approximation, we can think that there is one polymer molecule of DNA per cell. So the question then arises, if there is just one polymer molecule, can we use some meaningful polymer physics to understand something about what happens to DNA in chromosome? So as I already mentioned about viruses, the first thing, if you start thinking about this DNA in chromosome from that point of view, the first thing you have to worry about is the fact that DNA is very strongly negatively charged and therefore doesn't want to be densely packed. How you deal with the charges? And I forgot to mention, I copied here an interesting story about Zim and Kavenov, how they came to this experimental discovery. And I will not read it. I guess it will be published, this, so.
It appears on the website.
If you want to know, if you are interested in history, then I invite you to read this paragraph here. It's about how Bruno Zim invented this experiment while washing dishes at home. So it's an interesting story. And if you wash dishes in the evening, then you should entertain yourself trying to invent something similarly powerful. Okay, so how DNA is doing with the charges? It's strongly negatively charged, so it's obvious that it is thirsty for positive charges. If there are positive macromolecules around, it will stick to DNA. Of course, there are always other small positive charges, sodium, potassium, even hydrogen. But if you imagine difference between attaching to DNA one molecule with charge one plus 100 versus 100 molecules of plus one, you realize that entropically it's much cheaper, much easier to attract a big molecule, which is why actually, there are some histones, positive, mostly positive, positively charged proteins, which actually attach to DNA. But they actually evolved to become very peculiar objects, because eight of them together, eight of these protein molecules, form so-called histone octamer. And the beautiful part of it, which is not always appreciated, that most positive charges sit actually on these tails. And these tails, they are flexible, they are intrinsically disordered, but they, with their positive charges, they hug on DNA from outside and keep it this way, they keep stability of DNA. Okay, so these tails are centrally important objects in the story. So this is histone octamer, and this is nucleosome. So nucleosome structure is known to great details, and I show this picture not because I understand it very well. I don't remember it, but I want to emphasize two things. First, this was deciphered by X-ray analysis. So they were able to crystallize this thing. And it's incredible that you can understand X-ray diffraction picture of such a complicated, massively complicated object. So it's truly heroic effort. This is the level of heroism involved in this, I cannot overestimate. And I want to emphasize that this is sort of the end of the road. You can do X-ray analysis of bigger. You start from small proteins, you start from very small molecules, you go to small proteins, bigger proteins. Eventually you go to this monster, but that's about it. You cannot do bigger things with the X-ray analysis. So besides, of course, my other motivation to show this picture to you is just to show a beautiful picture. If you close your eyes on the details of these beads, then you discover that on larger scale, your chromatin, which is this functional form of DNA in the cell, has many of these nucleosomes and forms what is called 10 nanometer fiber, which is the string of these pearls on the string. So you can now think of this polymer physics problem. It's almost like a step in the renormalization group. You, instead of talking about DNA polymer, you speak about this string of these pearls, 10 nanometer fiber. So basically, the same picture with this car. Instead of 2 meters of DNA, you have 20 centimeters of this 10 nanometer fiber. The nucleus size is still the same. So 20 centimeters is, of course, smaller length than 2 meters, but still it's too much. You have now a rope which is not 1,000 kilometers, but 100 kilometers. Still 100 kilometers of a rope placed in the car will hopelessly tangle, and the same set of problems will be there. Okay, so this helps to understand how DNA is packaged, but does not solve it. Okay, so this guy, Jonathan Widom, he was super enthusiastic about the idea that he was actually very forcefully pushing the idea that nucleosomes are positioned on the sequence of DNA, on DNA molecule, in a peculiar way. There is nucleosome positioning, which is a code which represents some information, so on and so forth. For instance, there is this DNA occupancy profile in certain place of the genome, and you see that there are places where nucleosomes are likely, and there are some places where nucleosomes are not so likely, like here. And these places where they are not likely are the places where some regulatory elements are positioned and so on. Probably this is true. He passed away early, and somehow this field is now less enthusiastically developed than it used to be under his tutelage. But nevertheless, probably there is some truth to it. I will not go into this, not only because I don't know very much, but it may not be so important for what I want to tell you about. Still larger scale. So how do we go about going about this 10 nanometer fiber? Yes, 10 nanometer fiber may be not entirely uniform. Sometimes the spaces between nucleosomes are longer, sometimes shorter, but nevertheless you have some sort of 10 nanometer fiber. So my point that I already did is that above this scale of nucleosome, you have to have another method. That method would not bring you further. Okay, so what textbooks say? So this is the most famous textbook. I'm sure many people know this textbook. And this textbook is reprinted every few years. And every time that there is a new edition, this picture about hierarchical structure of genome changes. You see that this 10 nanometer DNA is firmly established. 10 nanometer fiber is firmly established. Now the next step, you see every edition they draw something different. There is some sausage appearing in 2008. So, trust me, this evolution of image is not driven by scientific knowledge. It's not driven by new discovery. It's driven by lack of discovery, by the fact that they realize that they don't know what to draw here and decide to draw different things. I also like this, when I went to buy a copy of this book, I went to Amazon website, and you know there are some readers who choose to write something about it. And one guy said, "Beautifully illustrated book. You don't have to read the text. You can only look at the pictures." Okay. So this is, of course, DNA and chromosomes, and everything in biology, there are exclusions. So apart from DNA in the chromosomes, there is extra chromosomal DNA, which is important in many, or maybe in all, I didn't understand, cancerous cells. And this extra chromosomal DNA is a set of rings, and we will speak about set of rings later. So this set of rings, they sit outside of chromosomes, and when the cell divides, there is special machinery which takes pairs of chromosomes apart and brings them separately in one cell, one chromosome, and the other cell another chromosome. But there is no similar machinery for this extra chromosomal DNA, and they end up in one of the two daughter cells randomly. Accordingly, there is for the genes which sit on this extra chromosomal DNA, there is very strange Darwinian evolution, which is based on a random distribution of genes between two daughter cells. So it's a whole interesting story. But for now, I just wanted to fix the point that there is extra chromosomal DNA and this is rings. We'll come back to this. Okay, so back to the table of various organisms and how densely is DNA packed there. And now, instead of just the ratio of length of genome over the diameter of domain where it's packed that I showed to you before, I now want to look at the volume fraction of how concentrated this object. Again, the goal was to find out if we can use some ideas from polymer physics to understand something about one polymer chain that forms one chromosome. And in order to use polymer physics, we need to know how concentrated this is. So if you go through this, for instance, for humans, if you go through this analysis, which is the simple arithmetic, you discover that, in fact, this number is pretty difficult to estimate very accurately, but it's more or less in this range. So between 2 and 30% of volume in the nucleus, overall in the nucleus, and there are different places in the nucleus, of course, but if you take overall, it's between these two numbers. That is the volume fraction of 10 nanometer fiber. It's difficult to estimate because 10 nanometer fiber is, of course, an uneven object, so how you delineate which volume is inside, which is it's a little shaky defined quantity, but my point is that whatever this number is, 2%, 30%, it's a big concentration. I want to say that this is a big concentration. My point is to say that this is a big concentration. And even for yeast, it's still a big concentration. So how do we know that it's a big concentration? So let me walk you through this simple estimate. So for double-stranded DNA, persistence length is 50 nanometers. Persistence length, for those who don't know, is the length which characterizes how flexible is the polymer, and roughly it is length over which polymer can be considered straight and beyond which it wiggles and twists and coils up and so on. So for double-stranded DNA, it's 50 nanometers. For chromatin fiber, it's not defined very well and not determined very well, but it's more or less in the same ballpark. It's a couple times bigger, but not dramatically bigger, because there are spacers between nucleosomes, and this, of course, means that it's sufficiently flexible, roughly on the same amount of flexibility that DNA itself. Surprisingly, the least well-known number is contour density. You know exactly how many base pairs are in your DNA, but how it translates to the length is unclear. In fact, as I will tell you later, when the presently very popular process of loop extrusion is taken into account, you discover that, in fact, this 10 nanometer fiber makes little loops. And when you have loops, you obtain something like a bottle brush. And this density, how many base pairs you have per unit length, obviously changes very much. If along the length you have these side loops, it increases your density. This density is a very important thing, because of course if you take this density you can find the length of 10 nanometer. Length of double-stranded DNA, it is 2 meters, that I told you, 6 billion base pairs, 3 base pair per nanometer. here 6 billion base pairs, but this density is not known very well, and so it's roughly, well, we can say 10 centimeters, but it's, you will see when we speak about entanglement length, you will see that this makes significant difference, whether it's 40 base pairs per nanometer or 120 base pairs per nanometer. So, but total length is this. Okay, so with this length, let's say 10 centimeter, we can consider, you know, consider according to Zim and Kavenov, you consider one chromosome, which is one polymer chain of this length, with this persistence length. So you discover that for the simplest Gaussian coil, you discover that J radius of this coil, spatial size of this coil, you can estimate this total length of the polymer times persistence length and divide by 3. Why divide by 3? I can explain to you, but you can take my word that it's divided by 3. Okay, it's not very important when you do order of magnitude estimate. Okay, so you just go through the arithmetic and you discover that this is about 50 micron. So 50 micron, remember, nucleus is 10 micron, and this is one chromosome. We have 23 pairs of chromosomes. So obviously, volume fraction of such coil would be volume of the fiber itself, length multiplied by cross-section area, divided by volume occupied by the coil. And if you go again through the arithmetic, it is about 0.01%, right? And remember, it is compared to this 2%, 1%, I don't care. In any case, it is huge compared to this, which means you are very far above what Degen called C star, and C star is this concentration in which, at which coils start to touch each other. It's like the concentration at which a subway train switches from early morning hour to rush hour, when passengers start feeling elbows of one another. Okay, so we are in condensed type of polymer situation, in concentrated solution or condensed, maybe each chromosome is a globule of some sort. It is a condensed object of what kind of different question, but it must be a globule of some sort. So if you take Zeeman-Kavenov discovery that each chromosome is one polymer chain, and just go through simple logic, simple arithmetic, you discover that it must be a globule of some sort. Okay, so that means the picture that you should, your mental picture of what is inside. If you were, when I was a boy, there was a nice book that I liked very much about boy and girl who became very, very, very tiny, small, and they were traveling through inside of human body and looking at various things from inside. And it was very interesting. So if you were to become such a small traveling boy or girl, and go inside cell nucleus, inside nucleosome, you will see a picture like this, where all these polymer chains are pieces of your 10 nanometer fiber. Around you, there were many, many, many different things. It's not that you see your one and everybody else is. Maybe those around you are different parts of the same chain. Maybe there are different chains. It's a different question, but there will be many things around you. Okay? Mesh size here, you can estimate the mesh size. So again, you know 10 nanometer fibers, fiber length 10 centimeter, you know volume of your nucleus, and this will be the estimate of the mesh size. So it's about 0.1 micron or 100 nanometers, which is roughly. So what is the meaning of this number? This number is roughly, I would say that it is similar to this proverbial average temperature of all patients in the hospital, in the sense that a real nucleus, he has euchromatin and heterochromatin, and you have places with very different densities. In places with different densities, of course, the size of this mesh will be very different. But roughly, to have an idea, so it's about 0.1 micron, and therefore there are roughly 100 meshes across the whole nucleus. If it's 10 micron big, it's roughly 100 meshes across nucleus. So this is the type of thing that you're thinking about. So what is next in terms of experiment? Back to experiment. In terms of experiment, as I told you, there is no chance that you can possibly pull up further, push X-ray to go further. And what can you do? So this man suggested that what you can do is so-called fish. Fish, I never remember these words, but I wrote it here. So this is the thing. And basically, what he discovered, there are many pictures here. The essence of it is that the essence is this picture, that each chromosome occupies its own territory. It is, in fact, important to say that this is interface chromosome. Interface, there is cell cycle. I will not talk about this very much. But interface is the biggest, longest part of the cell cycle. Well, cell just leaves and does not divide. When cell divides, it's a whole separate story. I will not touch upon it. So if you are talking about the cell that just functions, it's interface. And in interface, chromosomes are not condensed, not particularly small. Together, they more or less fill the whole volume of the nucleus. And there are many chromosomes in this particular human cell, and each of them occupies its own territory. So other pictures, it's painstakingly, carefully analyzed that if you look at it, it's not the effect of two-dimensional projection. This territorial segregation, in fact, whatever the projection you look at, in whichever direction, three dimensions you look at, it is a real thing. So I will not go through this. So this is the biggest picture. So chromosomes are territorial. Why is it so important? It's so important because it is in direct contradiction with the cornerstone of polymer physics, which Degen called Flory theorem. Flory never called it Flory theorem, but Degen gave it a beautiful name under which it is known to everybody now. It is Flory theorem. And one thing that is very difficult for me to teach when I teach this subject is to make sure my students hear the difference between Flory theory with Y at the end and Flory theorem with EM at the end. So this is Flory theorem. All right, so this is experimental demonstration of Lorentz theorem on spaghettis of two different colors cooked together in the same pot, and then you see that they do not segregate. They do not form territories. They just intermix. And this is the essence of Lorentz theorem. Every spaghetti in the pot behaves as if there are no other spaghettis. It's Gaussian. Okay, so how do you reconcile these two pictures? Of course, as always, in biology, you have an option to say, oh, there is a demon called separase, or some other biological, quasi-biological word. But this is not interesting. Maybe there is another explanation for it. But this is a question. Okay, so are there other polymer systems which are territorial? Here is a recent experiment where people tried to create territorial polymer system which violates polymer physics in this sense. So how did they do it? They performed the called electrodeposition, which means that they used very, very dilute solution. You see C less than C star. I told you the Jean called this concentration C star. So this is this very C star. So at concentrations less than C star, when you eject very, very, very tiny very tiny droplets of liquid, each droplet contains at most one polymer chain. And then when droplet is so small, solvent evaporates very rapidly. When solvent evaporates, imagine the droplet like this, and then solvent evaporates and compresses the polymer chain. And then very tiny, strongly compressed polymer chain is deposited on the surface, and on the surface, this way you deposit many of them, you obtain a film which consists of tiny little nanoparticles, each of which is separate polymer chain. So if you do it like this, or you do a simulation which simulates similar process in a computer, you discover that indeed you obtain a melt, or very concentrated solution, which is territorial, which is like this. So it's not entangled, and each of the chains is. So this is a good example of experimentally realizable territorial polymer. And there is the reference. So those are people associated with Polymer Research Institute in Mainz. Kurt Kremer is the lead author, but he, of course, mostly is in charge of simulation, and there are experimental people who perform this beautiful electrodeposition experiment. So it's possible. And there are other possibilities, but still you see that it requires significant effort. And normally, normal, regular and melt looks like this. So this looks very much like this spaghetti experiment. Okay, so what is beyond fish and territorial? By the way, I told you that you should feel free to interrupt me and ask questions. Theoretically speaking, if you wait long enough, this thing will go here. How long is long enough is a different question. It's difficult. In a real experiment, what they did is they actually perform this electrodeposition at the temperature at which this melt wants to become a glass. So they actually studied it at the temperature and concentration such that roughly this state becomes a glass. Then no long time is long enough.
So it's like piling up plastic beads?
Pretty much like this, yes. But if you do it in still a liquid state, then perhaps, yes, if you wait long enough, then you have to go here.
So that probably doesn't explain why you need loose and make territories.
Well, it does not explain for many reasons, but it's one of the, in my thinking at least, it's one of the ingredients that potentially can go and help us explain it. It's not the end of the story. It's not the end explanation. Oh, here it is. Goodbye. We can go drink beer and forget about the problem. It's okay. So the next step, which I think is in fact similar to the power or in importance as an experimental discovery, this is, in my opinion, similar to the discovery of neutron scattering from which I started, which is this method of mostly known as Hi-C. So it's a whole series of methods, chromosome conformation capture, which is 3C, and then there is 5C, and so on. So how does it work? Most of you guys probably have seen this very picture, which I copied from the same place that everybody else. And this whole thing was invented by this man, Job Dekker. So how does it work? It works in several steps. The first step is to cross-link DNA. When you have to cross-link DNA in the nucleus. So the first thing that you have to realize is that this first step kills the cell, period. Irreversibly kills the cell. The second step is to cut DNA, to chop DNA into pieces by restriction enzymes. So since the cell is already dead, that is fine. Then there are some technical steps which I will not speak about and which I probably don't understand well enough. But the essence of these other steps is just to fish out of the resulting mixture, where there are many pieces of linear DNA, you fish out these objects. And taking these objects, and you sequence them. You just sequence these pieces of DNA. And since you know the sequence of the whole genome, your computer identified that this piece was taken from here on DNA, and this orange piece was taken from somewhere here. And so therefore you say, oh, this crosslink happened to be between piece of DNA which I call monomer S1 and monomer S2. Of course it's not monomer, it's not base pair, it's some significant size chunk of DNA. So from here to here. Okay, so then step 6 is repeat this many times, construct this matrix of matrix elements S1 and S2. At step 7, I don't know what is step 7, I think that step 7 goes talk, or Stockholm and collect your Nobel Prize. I think it is a Nobel Prize work, but I don't know. I am not a member of this Nobel Prize committee. So the result of this is this beautiful high sea maps. And I'm pretty sure almost all of you saw tens and tens and tens and dozens of these high sea maps of various places. So this is from the first publication related to this high sea map. So this is from a little less old, I should say, article on this subject 10 years ago, and this is kilobase pair resolution. And it's amazing how this every piece you can look, you can increase resolution and look here and look here and look here. And they make very big splash about these dots at the corner of the square. I may come back to the dots. There are lots and lots of things. No, this is huge source of information, and I would say huge. I even wrote it at the title of one of my transparencies. I don't see it right now. That it's huge source of information and huge source of inspiration. It's really huge. So one of the big discoveries produced by this Hsi method is the discovery of so-called topologically associated domains, which are called in modern parlance TADs. It's now a word, TADs, you hear all the time, TADs. Although I have to tell you that the word topology here is shamelessly abused. There is nothing topological about this topologically associating domain. No topology whatsoever of any kind. Why they call it this way, I don't know, but nevertheless, it's a name now. So this topologically associating domains is hugely important, for instance, in regulations of various things. You see that in different species, this boundaries between these topologically associated domains are sitting in the same place in different, in very, very different cells. So they explain the regulation why regular elements associated, such as enhancer associated with a certain gene, if they sit inside the same TAD, the same topologically associated domain, then they influence one another, and people know how. If they live in different ones, they do not influence one another. And if there is, if the boundary between these things disappears, then bad things happen in terms of development of the organism and so on. As you can imagine, I am not really an expert in any of this. So if you're interested, please, there is an original publication about it. I'm telling you that this is super important. Back to my polymer physics question, I want now to compare this article that I started with, which is almost half a century, practically half a century ago, and which is intersection of beautiful experimental idea, neutron scattering, and beautiful theoretical idea. And here is another article of 20 years ago, which is a beautiful experimental idea. And what I want to say is that it waits for proportionally beautiful theoretical idea. So what these people measured by neutron scattering is basically a correlation function between concentration of a polymer, or better to say, maybe concentration of deuterated parts of the polymer in place R and in another place R prime. Well, technically they measured Fourier transform of this, but okay. Now, what KC measures is to some extent a similar quantity, except it is more informative in one sense and less informative in the other. More informative in the sense that it has two new indices, I and J. Unlike this thing, which is the correlation between masses, essentially, this is correlation between monomer number I and monomer number J. Okay? But as it is, this high-C method doesn't measure the special distance, special resolution between them. It only measures when these two guys are close enough to form the crosslink. So roughly, if you allow me to say that crosslink is small, then roughly it is when this R equals to R prime. So this high-C map is related to this correlation function when it's basically the same place or very close. So how do people proceed from this? The way this works in practice is that people perform vast majority of theoretical studies associated or inherited from this high-C method run the following way. You take your favorite polymer model, you call it Gaussian, generalized Rouse model, you call it whatever you want. You run it on a computer by Langevin dynamics, molecular dynamics of some sort, and on your computer you perform cross-linking and all that. You essentially perform on your model, you perform high-C experiment on a computer. Generate a matrix, high-C map, and look at experimental high-C map and computational high-C map, scratch your head, and say, oh, looks, doesn't look similar. No, that model is not good. Take another model, modify the model. Oh, this looks similar, so the model must be. So these people have much intuition, and I honestly suspect that some of the people in my audience are involved in this type of analysis, and probably you guys have intuition on that, and this is a very noble thing to do. But I want to ask, is there something else that we potentially can do, and can we even ask, what should we do? So in this sense, I want to formulate a question to which I don't know the answer. So to me, the question sounds, what is the entropy associated with the high-C map? So suppose I took this, I don't provide the reference for this particular high-C map. I pulled it out from a random paper on this subject. So I don't care what, it just is an illustration. So suppose I have this high-C map. What can I tell in principle? What can I tell? In particular, how many spatial conformations are there that are compatible with such high-C map? So to me, high-C map is to some extent similar to the statement that, oh, this polymer chain is distributed in space with some density distribution. If there is density distribution, I know how to compute entropy as a functional of density distribution. For instance, if there is simpler, suppose I have polymer chain that is packed with certain volume, certain gyration radius. How does entropy depend on gyration radius? Well, people like Phil Pinkos analyze this, and there is answer. We know the answer to this. Similarly, if I have certain high C map, what can I say? How many polymer conformations are compatible with such an ICMAP. It's a difficult question for several reasons. One reason is that people frequently underestimate the fact that ICMAP is not a contact map. It's not a contact map. The fact that there is some red dot somewhere here does not mean that these two monomers are in contact. It means that the probability of them being in contact is a little higher than for neighboring monomers. But that doesn't mean they are in contact. If the matrix was to consist, were to consist only of zeros and ones, which would mean that it is contact map, then there are some papers, which I forgot to reference here, which were written in the time of great interest in protein folding, when people analyzed so-called 2D NMR, when you analyze precisely the cases when two amino acids are close in space, and so you have essentially for your NMR tells you that these two, monomer I and monomer J, are next to each other in every protein. Then it's a contact map. And then there are some results about the entropy of the contact map. This is not a contact map. This is a map of probability. So that means there are probability, by the way. Probability, there are two sources of randomness involved. When you see IC map, randomness that went into this have two sources. In one cell, there are, actually maybe better to say, there are three sources. In one cell, there are two possibilities. There is thermal motion. All these DNAs are moving, and places which come into contact, they come and go, due to thermal motion. This is number one. Number two, there is RNA polymerization. There are other things that happen because cell is alive. And that also generates some contacts that come and go. This is second source of randomness. Third source of randomness is that, of course, although there is such thing as single cell IC, but most IC experiments are done on the ensemble of cells, and therefore there are differences between cell and cell. So there are three, and all these three sources of randomness are convoluted together. So, to some extent, this is similar to what is known in physics as the difference between quenched average and annealed average. But maybe I will not go very deeply into that, just to tell you that, to emphasize that this is a map of probabilities. So, as an example, this question was analyzed, actually, I am surprised, but 1 second. Yeah. Yes, here. So this question was actually, or similar question, was first analyzed by André Orlan and his co-workers several years ago. They discussed it, and more recently, a similar approach was developed by Tino Malai. They also discussed this question. They, in my opinion, or not yet done with this question, but this is what they have done. They assume that the polymer chain is Gaussian. It does not mean that it's what is called Gaussian polymer in polymer physics textbook, which means polymer that consists in series of Gaussian springs. There could be springs in many other places, like in this picture. This monomer can be connected by springs not only to its neighbors, but to other monomers as well, with spring constant, different spring constant. Doesn't matter. If all the springs are harmonic, the resulting distribution is Gaussian, and if the distribution is Gaussian, then you see that the probability that I and J monomers are certain distance r apart, it is Gaussian distribution. And if it is Gaussian distribution, then the probability that this r is zero is simply 1 over cube of the characteristic distance between them. So if you measure this probability that these two guys meet, then essentially you can translate it into the distance between them. Okay, so this A is the size of your crosslink, the size of formaldehyde that makes a crosslink. So Tirumalai, for some reason, emphasized that if this A is not small compared to the spread of the Gaussian, then you have to be careful and you have performed this integral, which involves the error function that you can guess when you integrate the Gaussian exponential, then there is error function, and then the distance between two mean square average distance between two monomers as a function of this measured probability is something like this. So this is just to illustrate the idea that if you measure the probability, then you can, in principle, you can try to extract from it some spatial information, how this thing, some entropic information, some physical information. I do not know. I'm not.
What about this?
Maybe.
People haven't done that.
I wouldn't be able to claim that people have not done it. I am not aware of people fruitfully doing it. Okay, but so in this type of argument, you can at least start extracting information about some physical property from this map of probabilities, high C maps. But of course, from this average distance, even if you are able to measure it, the distance to finding the confirmation, Tirumalai tries to make next step. He assumes that what is the most typical conformation that has this given set of pair distances. So he starts from this matrix, which is high C map, matrix of probabilities, transforms it according basically to this formula or to this slightly more sophisticated formula, transform it to the map of pair distances between different monomers, and then he says, let's assume that a conformation which is realized is a typical conformation, which means among all possible conformations which are characterized by this matrix of pair distances, let's take maximum entropy version. Okay, so maybe. But notice that this is based on the assumption that this is a Gaussian object. So why is it based on the assumption that this is a Gaussian object? Roughly out of great respect for Carl Friedrich Gauss. I agree, I like Gaussian distribution too, and Gaussian distribution is very nice, but this is not a good enough argument to me. So in particular, I mentioned already de Clauzot in one of my first slides. De Clauzot analyzed similar question for what he called a real polymer chain. At the time, half a century ago, polymer chain in a good solvent was called real, unlike Gaussian chain, which was called ideal. at the time. So ideal and real, like ideal gas and real gas. So it's real polymer chain with exclude volume. So he wanted to know, he wanted to know what are the values of critical exponents. And by the way, I have special affection to the Clouseau because he was actually, for me, he was the first Western physicist to whom I had chance to speak in person. Moreover, he was the first non-Soviet Union-born person whom I saw at short distance, not on the TV screen. De Clouseau, Jacques de Clouseau, wanted to know what about the probability of meeting two monomers in the real chain, in the real polymer chain. So this is other copies from his textbook, and I especially emphasize the equation number. So you can imagine the thickness of the book, which has this in the middle equation under this number. This is a very, very serious and very good textbook for its purpose. So he developed an argument, which is summarized here, which describes the probability distribution of meeting between two monomers. And it turns out that whether these two monomers are two ends or end and somewhere in the middle or two monomers in the middle, these probabilities are different. And they are different by certain values of the exponent. I suggest that we concentrate on this one. But the argument basically is summarized here. So the essence of the argument is that probability distribution of the distance between these two monomers. And this probability distribution, remember, it is something that is related to our contact map. And so if it is self-similar object, we don't know if chromosomes are self-similar, but if, then it should be average distance to the power minus d, d being space dimension. So this must be there because of normalization, right? And then there is, stupid me, it's r and x are the same thing. X is r. So r divided by average r. This is scaling function, which must be some sort of power here. And this power is theta 0, theta 1, theta 2, depending on what kind of monomer you have. And then there is this exponential decay. So at small distances, it is a power law function of distance. At large distances, there is cutoff exponential, but stretched exponential. The power y is actually related to Pincus blobs and so on. And it's basically this. And so you have this. So if this r, the distance, if you now want to bridge this to the contact map, you say that distance between these two monomers is this a elementary distance, the size of formaldehyde crosslink. So this dependence on r is not interesting. But depending on s, the distance between these two guys along the chain is exactly what you're interested in. Okay? And then there is this exponential cutoff. So basically, what I want to say is that for this particular model, I'm not saying that this model is useful for chromatin, but for this particular model, the relation between distances, distant matrix, and contact matrix is different than for Gaussian chain. For the Clouseau model, it's different than for Gaussian. So the assumption that it's Gaussian does not come for free. It is paid for. So whether this has to do anything with chromatin or not remains to be seen, and we will, I hope, we will come back to this in one of my next lectures. But for now, I want to say that for the Clozo himself, this why and this whole thing was tied into the fact that nu was Flory exponent, was this exponent of excellent volume polymer, 0.6 or whatever, 0.58. In fact, I went through this argument carefully with you because I never mentioned that this nu must be Flory exponent, maybe anything. This argument, the Clozo argument, keeps working for any self-similar object, whatever nu is. And I hope that at some point we can use it or some generalization of it, and I hope to come back to it for something more related to chromatin. Okay, so now I have two more slides about dynamics, but it depends on the time. So I am already speaking for hour and 15 minutes, so maybe it's time to stop and postpone this for next time. Thank you very much.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.